There's absolutely nothing wrong with him. I can prove it.
Of course there's something wrong with him. Probably been stealing since he could crawl.
That man is a product of a poor environment. Given the right surroundings and encouragement, I'll bet that man could run our company as well as your young Winthorpe.
I suppose you think Winthorpe, say if he would lose his job, would resort to holding up people on the streets?
If he lost his job and his home and his fiancée and his friends, I'm sure he'd take to crime like a fish to water.
Are we talking about a wager, Randolph?
We've done it before.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus review of Trading Places.
Merry Christmas!
I have a hunch something very exciting is going to happen this morning.
Hosted by Arnie.
You're so hot-tempered, darling.
Stuart.
People like this are a menace to decent society.
And Jacob.
He's the product of good environment.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
There's some strange shit going on here, Coleman.
Listener discretion is advised.
You with me?
Yeah, but we gotta kill him, motherfucker! We gotta kill him!
Today we are discussing Trading Places, starring Dan Aykroyd, Eddie Murphy, Ralph Bellamy, Don Ameche, Denholm Elliott, and Jamie Lee Curtis, directed by John Landis. Merry New Year! I am Arnie, co-host of Now Playing.
And Stuart.
And this is the co-host who has a chain belt in podcasting, Jacob.
Merry Christmas, actually, but New Year's is coming up soon. We are at the end of our Christmas Advent calendar with this surprise review for patrons. Thank you for being a patron, and hope you're having a good holiday season.
I was surprised. I mean, I knew we were recording the show. I watched the movie. But when you said we're going to make the Christmas movie this year, Trading Places, I was like, is that a Christmas movie? I get this movie confused.
It's about as Christmas as Die Hard.
No, because Die Hard, I knew enough to know that it took place around the holiday. This one, I didn't watch it when it was on cable a million times, in the 80s. I just, even though I saw most of Eddie Murphy's 80s work, this one I didn't get to until maybe 6 or 7 years ago. I was traveling to Philadelphia, and I looked up, sometimes I'd like to do a travelogue and see movies that feature the town of where I'm going, and they said this was a good one to do. I hadn't seen it before then, and even my memory from 8 years ago, I didn't recall that Christmas played into the storyline.
Okay, so you have seen it before. I was really thinking you might not have.
He was writing down the landmarks. He wasn't really paying attention to the story. He's like, oh, the Liberty Bell. Yes, I gotta go there.
Yeah, pretty much.
I'm kind of in a similar boat to you, Stuart, because I did see this when it was on cable a million times in the 80s. Like, I remember my dad's like, oh, you gotta watch this. It's all about nature versus nurture. But I kind of count this as a first-time viewing because, one, it's been a very long time. I remember some key scenes. I remember the basic plot. But I've never seen the theatrical version. I didn't know there were so many boobies in this film because I had always watched it on TV as a kid.
And I saw this on TV as a kid. I can't exactly remember when. I was definitely in my Eddie Murphy phase, but it was on network broadcast premiere. I watched it then and really enjoyed it. And then I got it on VHS and watched it a couple of times and we're like, yay, boobies, because I was, what, 14?
good 14-year-old booby movie. Yes.
And then I grew up and it started being played on cable and things, and I'm like, yeah, I remember liking that movie. And it's funny, the John Landis, Eddie Murphy movies, with the exception of Beverly Hills Cop 3,
wow,
I find them so much funnier as an adult than I did as a kid. And I just don't think I got a lot of the humor. And so as a kid, I watched it and I just liked seeing Eddie Murphy scream a lot. And, you know, especially in those early scenes doing what Eddie Murphy does. But now I watch this movie a couple times a year. It comes on and I'm just like, yeah, I'm going to watch Trading Places. Definitely around Christmas time. This is certainly a Christmas movie. iTunes currently has it with new cover art.
Are you serious? They got Dan Aykroyd as Santa?
They have Dan Aykroyd as Santa being hugged by Eddie Murphy in a snow globe with dollars.
That is so misleading.
I don't no, I get it. It certainly watching it, knowing we were putting it out when we were putting out, I can see how you saw it as a holiday movie. Certainly, it talks a lot about commerce, which is a part of our Christmas holiday, right? And that was what I mostly associated with this movie. There were many films in the 80s, screwball comedy types, that tried to talk about, yeah, the traders, the stock market, the whole obsession with capitalism.
Yeah, Brewster's Millions?
Yeah, I get the movie confused. I forgot that they were two separate movies.
So did my wife. She thought that's what I was watching.
Yeah. And I think this was supposed to be a Richard Pryor movie at some point. Every Eddie Murphy movie, at least the early ones, start out as Richard Pryor movies that he said no to.
This movie was written for Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder as they were coming right off of Silver Streak.
Yeah. Which is, I think, their best film. I mean, it's been a while since I've seen it, but
yeah.
I can understand why you would put them in it.
And Richard Pryor had some issues around this time and didn't want to do it. And so Paramount, who had made 48 Hours and made Trading Places, was like, have you heard about this Eddie Murphy? Saying to John Landis, 48 Hours hadn't even come out yet, but the preview screenings that were going on had such a response, the studio had turned around from saying, if you don't fire Eddie, we're firing you, to the director of 48 Hours, to, hey, Landis, what do you think about this Eddie Murphy being your new Richard Pryor?
Was John Belushi off SNL by then? Like, Landis didn't know about this guy from SNL? He has all those connections.
At this point, John Belushi was off the world. He had died.
Okay.
Yeah, in 1979, the last of the original players left. 1980, which was Eddie Murphy's first season, was a complete reboot. Nobody who had been on before 80 was on starting in 80.
So Aykroyd wasn't on it anymore, obviously.
No, they didn't know each other until this movie. I mean, I look at it and I'm like, oh, you're bringing in SNL people. That's how I kind of looked at Ghostbusters, too. And here it was Landis who talked to Walter Hill and was like, I hear you worked with this Eddie Murphy guy. What was he like? He's like, yeah, he can be funny, but he's really raw when it comes to acting. You might have some problems there. And Landis watched a tryout reel, flew to New York, and hired Eddie Murphy. But Murphy said, I'm not going to do this if you still have Gene Wilder. I am not going to be looking like a substitute Richard Pryor. Just refuse.
And I think Dan Aykroyd was really suffering at this point because his partner in comedy, I think, gets more credit, really, than him. I mean, Blues Brothers, all the best bits, all that stuff, you really think of John Belushi. He had died of his cocaine overdose, and Dan Aykroyd was putting out crap like Dr. Detroit. So I don't know that many people thought that he had a future.
He'd have Ghostbusters in a year.
No, this movie got him Ghostbusters.
Oh, okay.
They weren't going to greenlit this movie, but because this was a hit, he got that.
Yeah, Paramount said he is over. We will not ever hire him again. Landis went to bat for him because, remember, Landis did Blues Brothers. And Landis knew Aykroyd could do this part. He knew Aykroyd was more than the Aykroyd-Belushi duo. And so Aykroyd had to take a big pay cut, but he got this. Same with Jamie Lee Curtis. Nobody wanted to hire Scream Queen Jamie Lee. She had just done Halloween 2. She'd passed on Psycho 2. Nobody would give her anything but horror. Landis wanted her. She took a major pay cut. She was paid $1 million for Halloween 2. Paid $80,000 to take off her top in Trading Places.
Wow.
But it set her career on the right path, too. This was a career-launching or relaunching movie for just about everybody involved.
Except for John Landis. You know, we keep mentioning him, but we've actually never covered one of his movies before. He was on an upswing. He actually is one of the rare directors that moves between horror and comedy quite well. Like, he had made American Werewolf in London, and he had made Animal House, and he had made Blues Brothers. So I think he was on a high. Eddie Murphy, this was his second film. But yeah, you're right. Everyone else is being pulled out of mothballs or had been prematurely dismissed as not right for the part.
Well, I wouldn't say Landis was on a really high part.
Not till he gets in the helicopter or Twilight Zone.
Well, that's not happened yet.
Yes, it has.
It has?
It happened in 1982. This finished filming in 1983. Twilight Zone and Trading Places came out the same summer.
Oh my God. He got to work after the Twilight Zone.
But the lawsuits hadn't happened.
Oh.
The lawsuits were all pending during this time. And the lawsuits will all happen after Trading Places.
When he's got some money.
Wow. Okay, see, I thought all of that was yet to come for him, that this was maybe a career peak. He also did Thriller this year, so I guess, again, that horror and comedy mix that he seemed so right for. But yes, Twilight Zone, maybe one day we'll cover that movie more extensively. Obviously a very tragic story.
Yeah, and when Coming to America 2 comes out, we'll discuss more about Landis and how Eddie gave him that job as a favor, trying to help him get back. But yeah, this was post-helicopter, if you can believe it. I couldn't.
Oh, I had no idea. And again, it's such a hit. Maybe that's why Landis is given work to do, why he was able to do Coming to America. You're saying Eddie helped him as well. We'll save it, but I know that they're not as close after that film as they are making this film.
No, no. And so, yeah, they got the cast. You know, we'll talk about some of the other players. I don't know that they had other people in mind, but Landis was certainly doing casting that did not make Paramount very happy across the board, pulling Don Ameche out of mothballs and things.
Yeah, before Cocoon really, like, got him the Oscar and all of that. Yeah, these are Ralph Bellamy is, well, we talked about him in Rosemary's Baby. But again, these are all, yeah, classic. And it makes sense. I'm going to just go ahead and put it out there. When I saw this movie this time, I realized it really has the formula of a classic old-time 1930s screwball comedy. It feels old-fashioned. It feels right to have these old actors involved.
That's how you're going to contextualize a person in a gorilla suit having antics at the end?
I wasn't thinking of that scene per se, but really just more of the setup. The idea of, you know, in a Preston Sturges movie, there's always like the little patsy guy that gets manipulated and, you know, his life turned upside down. This formula, it doesn't necessarily play as an Eddie Murphy movie in the same way that Beverly Hills Cop or Coming to America does.
Well, this was only his second movie, and this feels far more like an Eddie Murphy movie than 48 Hours did. It's like, here he's in his milieu, you know, he's doing a comedy film, he's able to ad-lib, the director's indulging him, working with the script and him, but a lot of the stuff, he rewrote his character because he didn't like how it was written, because he says, I'd never say jive turkey. Why does my character keep saying jive turkey? And so it was Eddie getting a chance to really shine again. And, you know, he'd only have one more movie before he became the highest grossing comedy star of all time.
Yeah, this movie made more money than 48 Hours. He's building. Like, 48 Hours was what, $75 million? This is $90 million. One of the biggest films of that year. I think only Return of the Jedi and Flashdance in terms of endearment are bigger. So he's becoming, again, his second film. He's, what, 21, 22 years old filming this? He is, yeah, really close to superstardom.
Yeah. The very next year, Beverly Hills Cop hits. There's just, he's got a Willard Hayek film in between. We know Willard.
Yeah. Nobody wants to talk about Best Defense. So, Arnie, let's talk about this movie. Let's get a plot, and we can find out what happens in Trading Places.
Lewis Winthorpe III, played by Dan Aykroyd, was born into wealth and grew up to become a wealthy executive of Duke and Duke Commodity Brokers. He has a big Philadelphia house, a butler, and is engaged to the Duke's gorgeous grandniece, Penelope. Billy Ray Valentine, played by Eddie Murphy, grew up poor. When we first see him in this movie, he's grifting, begging for money by pretending to be a blind Vietnam vet who lost his legs in the war. When Billy Ray accidentally bumps into Lewis, it sets off a chain of events that will change both people's lives forever. Lewis believes he's being robbed by Billy Ray, but Duke and Duke's owners Mortimer Duke and Randolph Duke, played by Don Ameche and Ralph Bellamy, have been arguing about if personality is based on nature or nurture. Mortimer thinks it's all in the genes, but Randolph bets that with the right circumstances, Billy Ray could be as successful a businessman as Lewis, and Lewis could turn into a criminal like Billy Ray. The bet on, the two ruin Lewis's life by framing him for drug dealing. He loses his fiance and is locked out of his home. His only lifeline is a streetwalker named Ophelia, played by Jamie Lee Curtis. Ophelia can tell Lewis isn't lying and agrees to help him in exchange for money when he gets reestablished. But that proves difficult. Meanwhile, Valentine quickly becomes accustomed to having the finer things in life. His streetwise savvy makes him every bit as good at predicting market swings as Lewis was. Things come to a head on Christmas Eve. Frustrated, Lewis breaks into Duke and Duke to frame Billy Ray for drugs. When that doesn't work, Lewis pulls a gun on the reveling employees. He walks out and attempts suicide. That same night, Billy Ray overhears the Dukes discussing their plan, and that their plan ends with putting Billy Ray back on the streets and giving Lewis back his old life. But that's not the Duke's only plan. They're also involved in insider trading and plan to corner the market on orange juice. Billy Ray and Lewis team up. They swap the Duke's real OJ report with a fake. They borrow money from Ophelia, as well as Lewis's butler Coleman, played by Denholm Elliott, to stake their plan. On the opening day of the market, Billy Ray and Lewis use the information to become incredibly rich, while Duke and Duke, trading under incorrect information, lose everything. We see Lewis and Ophelia, now a couple, along with Billy Ray and Coleman, each with women on their arms, on the beach, living the high life, as credits roll.
Wow, I don't think I've ever heard so much about orange juice in a plot summary before.
And at Christmas?
Well, you know, Florida, oranges year-round. But yeah, Stuart, you mentioned Philadelphia, and watching this, as we say, with the now playing goggles on, I'm looking at the opening credits for the first time in a way I never have before, and I think this movie does a good way of bringing us into Philadelphia. It cuts back and forth. You see incredibly rich people getting in cars, you see poor people working in markets, you just keep cutting back and forth, they're playing Mozart, initially only the music, but as this goes on, you start hearing more and more sounds like trains and cars and everything coming in, and we get to see two sides of the city in a very quick montage.
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty smart opening, paying attention to it for probably the first time ever, because I hated credits as a kid. I never wanted to see them. But yeah, you get a nice little travelogue at the beginning. It feels like you're hitting the tourist spots. And then, like, I'm like, oh, okay, I see what they're doing. They're showing the working class, the kids playing basketball in the park, and then cutting to the rich folks. Like, I thought it was a nice way to set up the themes of this film.
I agree with you both. It's a really good opener, and it's putting Rocky statues next to the Founding Father statues. It says something. I think that was clever, but is this a big commodities market? I didn't know.
Artie, you wanted to be a stockbroker at 10. Tell us.
Commodities are different than stocks, and I'll state up front, I understand what happens at the end of this movie, but the commodities market itself mystifies me still.
So yeah. It's weird. It's not weird that an 80s comedy would go here, but it is weird that it's not Wall Street. I think I just always associate everything that happens in this movie with New York.
Yeah, at the beginning, my wife's like, this isn't New York. What are they trying to pass off as New York here? I'm like, it's Philadelphia. I guess they work off of Wall Street.
And maybe, who knows, maybe the commodities trading is bigger here than in New York.
They got those really fancy computers in this movie, so like they didn't need to be on the Wall Street floor.
Yeah, if you have people there, it is cheaper to have other places, and a lot of banks aren't headquartered in New York anymore. It is strange to me that it's in Philadelphia. They did this for thematic reasons. They wanted to be near the founding of America, and you know, they're trying to make a social commentary here. They're trying to talk about class and racism, and they just wanted to go to the founding place of America to kind of indicate, you know, if it's always been this way, and here we are in this city that is incredibly divided in this way. So they were trying to go more for a theme than logic. I, too, thought if you just asked me yesterday on the street, where does Trading Places take place? I'd be like, oh, it's a New York movie.
Mm-hmm. I do know the original script was called Black and White, and I do think that that is how they define the social classes here. What we will end up having is, yes, the white privileged man, played by Dan Aykroyd, who, again, he is getting his newspaper hand-delivered to him. Meanwhile, we'll cut to a black man on the street who's using yesterday's newspaper as a blanket.
Yeah, to see Lewis Winthorpe's life here, I don't even know that I would want it. I mean, his morning is so slow. How early is he waking up to have Coleman, his butler, do a straight razor shave every morning while he reads the paper, having all that breakfast in bed? I'm like, does he go straight from dead asleep to eating those eggs? I'm very confused, but it is certainly showing off wealth and, more importantly, how pampered he is. He doesn't have to pick out his clothes. Coleman does everything. He won't even open his own damn car door. He waits for Coleman to run down the stairs.
I love that scene. Yes, I love that scene. He just stands by that door, even though he beats Coleman to it, just stands there. And Aykroyd, he can do smug real well. Like, there's just something about the way he looks to have this upper crust feel like that looks down upon people. I think he does really good in this film.
Oh, that accent of his. I love the little erudite. I don't even know what the hell it is, but that accent.
I don't really like Danny Aykroyd. And I, even in movies where I like his movies, I usually find him the least interesting thing about it. But I do feel like you're correct. He's well cast in this because he feels like a little boy, that he's never grown up. And so he has servants to do everything for him. And he works for people who have even more servants and an even bigger mansion. And this is a world of privilege that, yeah, not only is it does not reflect a reality, I know, I think you're right, Arnie. We don't really want it when we look at it this way. These people looked feeble, helpless, and I just wouldn't want to be this caged. It looks like a very sad and lonely life.
But what you point out is we start with Lewis and we're seeing his life and we're like, oh, he's rich. He's got a butler, chauffeur, and the Mercedes and all those nice suits and everybody's greeting him at work. But then, yeah, we cut to Duke and Duke, and you're like, well, you thought Lewis had it good. These people have a cadre of employees who line up like a military service to greet them in the morning as they just walk down a red carpet from the door of their... It looks like a castle. I mean, it's all stone. It's a giant mansion into their Bentley, and it's like, it just one-ups Lewis in every way. And you're like, damn, this must be how Donald Trump lives.
And it's also telling as we learn about Lewis, like you think of him, oh, he's done really well for himself. And sure he has. He had a hunch about pork bellies and that's going to pay off at the beginning here. But like that house, not his. Like it's all been given to him by the Dukes because he's marrying that grandniece, I guess. So like they're letting him live in this house. Like, yeah, just stretch that engagement as long as possible. Just get that free rent.
I thought it was like a perk of his job. A lot of times you will get that. You get the corporate living.
A house? I've heard of a car, but not a house.
I have definitely heard of that giant corporations have reserved apartments and condominiums and expensive buildings specifically for execs as a salary boosting perk.
And to keep them close, you know, we know where you are, you know, you can't go too far from us. But yeah, it does set up this idea that they almost feel like the grandparents and this is a child that is a lot to learn. And so there's growth for Dan Aykroyd to experience here. He wakes up and all he thinks about is pork bellies. And apparently he's got good instincts about those kinds of things. I feel like the trading in this movie, it's not an easy concept for me to understand, but they do a pretty good job of handholding and explaining what we need to know about their business.
You know what's really helpful is when they talk a lot about pork bellies and then they end it with, hey, we made $374,000. I'm like, okay, it paid off. Whatever they're talking about, it worked. It was a good thing for them. Got it.
And I also think that it's connected to things in our life. You know, the bacon we eat, the frozen orange juice we make. It's things that the common man consumes. And yet somehow in the rich man's game, it's a way that they make, yeah, millions and billions.
Yeah, and they make it pretty simple for me because I understand even when I was 13 watching this film, I understood, you know, buy low, sell high. If you're buying, you want to buy the cheapest you can. If you're selling, you want to sell at the most you can. So when you got Lewis here, like, wait till it goes to 64, goes down to 64, then you're going to buy it at its cheapest and it's going to go up. Or the pork bellies, wait and sell until it's 75. You're going to sell at the highest price. And he's very good at guessing that. Plus, the fact that they don't call it bacon, pork bellies, that just is funny to me. It's just funny to think about pork bellies.
Yeah, a pork belly sandwich is a whole lot more expensive than a side of bacon, you know? It's a term that, again, it's something that is common. Like, it's something that every household in America would have on their table, and yet most households in America don't live like this, don't profit like this. And if they're doing so well, they should be flush. They should be able to hand out money and be gracious and be beloved benefactors. And yet when we see them, you know, there's Eddie Murphy's introduction. He's a panhandler on the street. Admittedly, it's a grift, but they slap him with a newspaper. And they're not even paying their butler more than a $5 Christmas commission either.
That's a split Christmas bonus, $2.50 from each Duke.
Yes. Don Ameche is so wonderfully villainous in this movie. I absolutely love him. He hadn't worked for 10 years before this movie. Nobody wanted to pay his salary. They thought he was done, and he was independently wealthy from the movies he'd done. Landis got him, fought through the studio. He is a gem in this. Because there are two brothers. There's Mortimer, and there's Randolph, and Mortimer is Don Amici. Don Amici is quite clearly the nastier of the two, whereas Randolph just pushes by Eddie Murphy. Mortimer's gonna just smack him repeatedly with the newspaper.
Yeah, and I think they set that up earlier on when you first meet these brothers. It's Randolph who's interested in the psychology of nature and nurture, and Mortimer, I don't want to hear anything about that. I just want to make money.
Yeah, these two are just really well cast. Love watching them here. And yeah, that little butler with the $5 Christmas bonus, you're learning who these characters are very well. And this is a comedy. It's got a solid plot to it, but we were discussing with 48 Hours, you know, how do you review a comedy? Here, with these little laugh lines like, I'll go see a movie by myself. I think Landis is a master at comic timing, and it here is keeping a smirk on my face the entire opening.
Right. And so we've set up two different worlds, and the people that are on some level wanting handouts from these dukes. Now, obviously, Dan Aykroyd earns his keep because he understands how to manipulate pork bellies. But on some level, he is living off of them in the same way that Eddie Murphy is trying to live off of them. They're two sides of the same coin. And then they're going to, you know, in true screwball fashion, they're going to meet cute here when the cops bust Eddie Murphy and he ends up literally running into Dan Aykroyd. Is this a bit from Saturday Night Live? I feel like I've seen Eddie Murphy, maybe not on the scooter, but maybe this is his Stevie Wonder impression. I feel like I've seen this character.
The head bobbing with the sunglasses is definitely his Stevie Wonder, 100%. You know, and I think he's not even trying to hide it, but he moves his head like a snake with a snake charmer. And even when they take the glasses off, that stare. To me, the great thing is when the cops lift him up and are like, yeah, you obviously have legs. He just rolls with it. Praise Jesus! I can see!
Yeah, and this has all got to be like improv stuff, right?
Totally.
This feels like a much more comfortable Eddie Murphy than 48 Hours, and a much funnier one.
And not all of it is improv. You got to give a lot of credit to the scriptwriters for giving a lot of these jokes, but Eddie Murphy was well cast. But no, he didn't just walk around making this stuff up.
No, he probably did his lines for a take and then had other ones as well.
I'm willing to bet that he insisted on being a panhandler because I think it would make more sense if he was a gambler. Because they're going to ultimately make the case that he understands the market because he intuitively has been doing this on the street. And so if he were playing cards or something like that, if we saw him playing games of chance in the early scenes, it would better set up why he ends up being such a good commodities trader.
Yeah, that wasn't ever the plan. They wanted to do the prince and the pauper. They just wanted him as poor as possible. If he was a decent gambler, he wouldn't need to be this poor and need such an upgrade in life.
Well, that's one of the notes I made, that give that to the writer, can improve this on a second draft, is I wanted, when we get into Eddie Murphy's side of the story, like, yeah, he's already really good at just guessing commodities and knowing, and I wanted more of that to come from his street knowledge. I don't, like, I'm laughing at all of his stuff. I just don't really get who his character is, because even when he gets arrested and goes to jail, like, it's all just jokes. I'm never learning about him, and then all of a sudden, he's this great commodities broker.
But everything is the bar in 48 Hours, right? I mean, when he's panhandling, he's pretending to be someone. Just like in the bar in 48 Hours, he walked in and pretended to be a cop and took charge of the situation. Here, he's...
Yeah, no, I love that. I feel, though, like when he puts on that suit, that humor is going to go, not in the film, but as a character, when he's dealing with the Dukes, it's not all jokes. He seems very serious and knowledgeable.
But when he bumps into Dan Aykroyd... Yes, Dan Aykroyd's career got a boost out of this, and he's very, very good in it. But Eddie Murphy is the shining light, right? I mean, his performance is the big one. He gets to be, you know, the Kramer to Jerry Seinfeld. He gets to be the really wacky one who's running around inside Duke and Duke, and all because Winthorpe was knocked down by a black man, so immediately thinks he's being robbed.
This is a little confusing for me. I understand that Billy Ray is being accused by a racist of attacking when he was just trying to avoid the police.
And yet he grabbed a suitcase and ran into the building and gave chase. Like, why did he do all that?
I think we're supposed to think that he wasn't stealing, right? He was just...
Correct.
for reasons, grabbing the suitcase, but that's a little wobbly there.
He was handing the suitcase back to Lewis. He was like, here's your suitcase, but Lewis was just in such a panicked condition.
Well, you just drop it and walk away, though. That you don't give chase inside someone's place of employment.
It's a little weak, but I get what they're going for. And, you know, you skate along with it. Here's an innocent man accused of something unfairly because of his race. And cruelly, Dan Aykroyd wants him prosecuted. Is not going to, you know, say, no harm, no foul. He didn't get away with it. So why would I prosecute this guy? He has no empathy. And so it is good on some level. Aykroyd is going to be reduced to street level so that he can have empathy.
Landis does not go above slapstick. There's a lot of slapstick in a lot of his movies. And here, I feel that when there's six guns trained on Eddie's head and he's like, is there a problem, officers? He's gonna have Eddie break the fourth wall in this. Humor is very subjective, but I think he's doing it well here. And of course, having Eddie delivering the lines is a gift. Landis could do half as good and still work well with Eddie.
Yeah, I mean, I think Eddie Murphy has a role that's more comfortable for him than 48 Hours because he is constantly coming up with characters and reacting to outrageous situations. I think that it is a more natural fit for his style of comedy than 48 Hours was. And, yeah, well, we can agree, this is a comedy.
Oh, definitely.
Does not fit in any other genre. It is largely here to generate laughs, whereas 48 Hours was, on some level, a gritty cop drama.
I'm surprised at how fast this moves. You know, when I put this in, I've watched this movie a lot. I never paid attention to the runtime. I put it in, I'm like, oh, this is almost a 2-hour movie, okay. And then it's like 15, 20 minutes in, and we already have the Dukes meeting Billy Ray, and immediately, like, okay, we're going to do this bet. We're going to swap Lewis for Valentine and see if they can become each other. If Lewis will become a criminal and if Valentine can become a honest executive. It's very efficient without feeling rushed.
I would actually argue that it takes a while. Like, I was surprised at the length of this movie and that it takes so long for the wager to come along. Typically, you'd want to prune 20 minutes out of this film and get this happening within the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, it feels like it's about 40 minutes till the premise really kicks into this film. Like, we're both the characters are set up because you got to set up a lot. They got to change places and you got to establish, you know, why Lewis can't access any of his millions of dollars or whatever he has in the bank. And so it does take a little while to get everything rolling. I think you get to the premise pretty quick, but to really set that up and push this ball into motion, you know, it does take a little bit, but I'm laughing throughout, so I'm not minding the time that much.
Yeah, it has a long Act One, which is not to say that it needed to be shortened, because I think, to Arnie's point, I think it's entertaining, even though just thinking in rules of comedy, you would want all of this to happen quicker.
Where I feel that the movie could trim a little bit, I mean, I think you need this stuff in here for storytelling reasons and for verisimilitude, but the part of the movie that I find least engaging, and I definitely can think of one scene that probably could have been cut, is Lewis's fall from grace. Aykroyd tries to keep it funny by going through it all with complete indignation and disbelief, but there's not a lot of jokes to be made there, and yet it's not dramatic either. I'm not like, oh, poor Winthorpe, oh my god, whatever's going to happen to him. It's just merely a series of machinations during which he has no control. The person who's pulling the puppet strings is Clarence Beeks, otherwise known as the principal from Breakfast Club.
Yeah, I think you're supposed to find it funny that once they finally plant the PCP, like, again, it takes a little while. At first, it's about stealing $50 from a coat room, and it was like, eh. But, like, eventually it'll get to the idea that this guy is a drug dealer and is going downtown, really is going to stay locked up. What ruins his life, frankly, it's a little hard to believe that oh my god, drugs on the trading floor? I can't imagine a trader that doesn't use cocaine or PCP. But in this movie's logic, they're trying to argue that this world shuns drugs and anyone that would use illicit substances.
I guess you had to have something strong enough to really be able to be a reason to take everything away from him. Because, like, the IRS is going to seize all his accounts because he's a drug dealer. And so I guess that's the it's a convenient way to get him to where he needs to be.
But I think this was all done because Clarence Beeks goes over and whispers to Frank Oz. Yes, the Muppet Master is here playing a police officer doing the intake. And I think it's Frank Oz who planted the PCP. He was bribed or something by Beeks, forces Lewis to do a strip search and all of this. The cop is making it as hard as possible for Lewis. And then, of course, the Dukes are going to pull whatever strings they need to tell the bank, who is, you know, probably every Duke and Duke executive banks there. Yeah, you don't want to do business with Lewis, and there's probably going to be an investigation. You want to freeze his funds. Tell Coleman the butler, don't let him in.
Yeah, I want to know why Coleman turns on. I guess Coleman, he knows who signs his paycheck. And so he's going to go along with this.
He says specifically, you are my employers and this is your house, so I will do what you say. But I love...
I would have liked a moment of, you know, contrition or something at the end where they have a little speech why he did that and apologizes.
He doesn't apologize, but I think later on when Lewis shows back up at the house and Coleman is like, I don't know who you are, Denholm Elliott gives one facial expression right there.
Yeah.
It's quick, but it's so character developing and allows us to have sympathy for Coleman to know he feels like shit doing this, all in one moment of a facial expression.
Yeah, I like that character a lot. And, butlers usually are good for that. Usually it is all about the sly reaction on their face because they're not allowed to show emotion. They have to do what they're told. I don't blame Coleman for going along with it because, yeah, he's told what to do. He hangs up the phone. He calls his bosses an asshole. But like everyone here, like the people at the bank, like the cop at the precinct, they are going to jump and call by these Dukes and Dukes. The Dukes and Dukes pull all the strings. And so it's not right, but it is the lay of the land. And so the fact that they're going to get the ultimate revenge is very satisfying. In the meantime, they're going to court Eddie Murphy.
Who you said during 48 Hours you saw some Bruce Lee in the fights. I didn't see that. But here he is doing Bruce Lee.
Yes.
Yeah. He's got to get out of jail and meet the Dukes. And you could almost make this movie... I know what you're saying about Eddie being the brighter star here. You could almost ignore Dan Aykroyd. It would make this a very lopsided story. You need his story. But I do feel like you're right. The more entertaining stuff is watching the poor man inherit the house and break vases and play in the jacuzzi.
Yeah, pocket things as he's being given the tour. No, you don't have to steal anything anymore. Like, again, Murphy's great here, just the way he'll pick up like a cigar box and stick it in his coat jacket.
And when he breaks the vase and Randolph's like, he just made us $15,000 because we overinsured it. And he's like, you want me to break some more? And all three men, Coleman and both Dukes, put up their hands simultaneously in a choreographed no.
Which, yeah, in some comedies would be awful. Like, I'd be, if this was Kevin James and David Spade and Adam Sandler doing that, I'd be rolling my eyes. But it all works here. Even these slapstick moments, like, Landis is able to pull that off. Just this weird, like, American Werewolf in London. I love that film. And you get this, like, these great scary transformations and then just a lot of humor. And he's able to keep that balance and tone.
Yeah, I think it helps that they have a really good script. I mean, I do think, I'll just go ahead and suggest it. While Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy are good in these roles, this script could work in other hands. You could have had Gregory Hines and Gene Wilder in this. You could have gotten Lou Gossett Jr. and Billy Crystal. I mean, I do think there are other people that would be just as successful in this. It would make it different. It would give a different quality. Who knows? Maybe Adam Sandler and I don't know. Who do you hate?
Chris Rock? I mean, Chris Rock always is with Sandler.
I don't hate Chris Rock, though.
Yeah, I like Chris Rock, but I don't see a lot of his Adam Sandler.
He did show up in those Grown Ups films, though.
Yeah, he was bad in that.
Yeah, I feel like this material here is strong enough that it would elevate them. And that's what I would argue. It's like this feels like it's not about the jokes that these guys are going to invent in the moment. It's not about the impersonations or the funny outfits, although that's an element. It's the compare and contrast that we see of rich man and poor man that makes it fun.
I'll say this as far as crediting the writers for a lot of the humor. You know, you think of something like Ghostbusters, and you could feel the improv there. And a lot of the humor there is just like looks and glance, especially Bill Murray. He's just able to tell so much with his face, disdain for people and all that, and it's funny. Here, I'm laughing at the actual lines, like the actual, like, jokes. It's not just about this vibe and this feel of the film. It's these lines are really funny.
Rapid fire repartee, like the stuff that I like about screwball comedies of the 1930s was, well, the talkie was new, so the emphasis was really to get good script writers and to keep those jokes coming, and so that's always here. You know, there is slapstick, but it isn't just physical comedy. We have a lot of verbal verve to keep it going.
But I thought back to something you said, Jacob, in our 48 Hours podcast about how a lot of times when comedians get movies, you then go and search out their stand-up and you're like, oh, the stand-up was just a vehicle for the movies. There is one joke Eddie Murphy gets here. You know, he's really afraid the Dukes are doing all this to get him in bed, you know, for gay reasons.
Oh, the gay panic stuff. Yeah, straight from the man wearing tight leather red pants making homophobic jokes. Yeah.
But the joke that really got me is when he's given the jacuzzi bath. He's like, when I was young, if we want jacuzzi, we had to fart in the bathtub.
A good line.
It is, but it reminds me so much of the bathtub butt humor he has of getting a G.I. Joe stuck up his brother's ass in Delirious. I mean, it's just, I feel like that was Eddie Murphy, something he already had in his repartee when he brought it to the movie.
Yeah, no, when he starts using, you know, derogatory terms for homosexuals and stuff, I definitely thought, I mean, go back and watch those 80s stand-up specials. A lot of that stuff in there.
Yeah, he got in trouble with that with Delirious and later films. It's here a little. I definitely saw it. But yes, this is where Eddie Murphy is. Again, I would make the argument, you could have a different actor in here that wasn't making those jokes, and you would still find this situation funny. You would still find the script and the movement and the comedy of it all working. The fact that it's Eddie Murphy here is just an added treat.
Agreed. And we find out while he's in jacuzzi that this isn't going to be long-term for him. Mortimer and Randolph say, get his clothes cleaned. He's going to have something to wear when we send him back to the ghetto.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, we already know these guys are not benevolent. They're not here to lift up the poor. This is all about a wager and really their competitiveness.
Yeah, for the usual amount, which we'll find out what that is at the end.
They don't really like each other. I mean, that will also become clear at the very end of this. They're brothers and they work closely with each other, but there's competitiveness. And again, I think that's a statement about capitalism of like, you might profit with each other, but you don't like each other.
I'm not sure Don Ameche likes anyone in this movie. Neither of them are married. Neither of them seem to have friends. They're bickering like an old couple. You know what they remind me of? And it's probably because Frank Oz is here, but those two old guys, Waldorf and Statler.
Yep.
Could they have made this more of a love story? Now, with Jamie Lee Curtis popping in here, she definitely brings, really, it's a real surprise because I do think of her in this era as a scream queen. And she does. She really brings something much needed. She helps Aykroyd be better in this movie, but she's a supporting character and Eddie Murphy gets no counterpart. I suppose the closest we get is Eddie Murphy. And maybe that's the point. As he gets richer, he cares less and less about his old friends. He tries to bring a bar of his old friends into the house and sweats that they're going to ruin his Persian rug. Maybe the point being made is Eddie is not going to meet a girl while he is playing rich, because when you're rich, you start caring more and more about yourself and not about others.
Again, that's what I'm talking about, where I would like a little bit more development with his character, because it's very bizarre at the end. We're on our yacht in the islands, and okay, of course, Jamie Lee Curtis and Dan Aykroyd are going to be together, and I expect Coleman, like this side butler character, to just have a random woman at the end, but then to see Eddie Murphy with a random woman, too, I'm like, was she one of the women at the bar that we saw earlier? Like, it does feel like he should have had some kind of love interest or something.
Yeah, this movie is packed with a lot, though. There's a lot of stuff going on. The thing is, each person has somebody to help them. You say there's no counterpart for Ophelia with Billy Ray. The counterpart is the Dukes. The Dukes are doing everything for him, the way Ophelia is giving Louis a place to live, as she calls him. And her introduction is great, too. I mean, she's just a streetwalker walking out of prison and has to humiliate Louis in front of his fiance, you know, just pretend to really need some PCP from him. I'll do all the things you like for just a dime bag, Louis. I mean, it's a hell of an introduction for a character. And yeah, coming at like the 30-minute mark.
Yeah, she, again, not who I would cast in this. It is a stroke of Landis genius that he saw Jamie Lee Curtis as the perfect. Did he audition her, or did he just get a sense that she was funny in ways that we didn't see in Halloween and Terror Train?
He'd worked with her before.
Oh, okay.
On a documentary or something. It wasn't like on a movie that she was starring in.
Was it a funny documentary?
Yeah, again, I mean, you get to know people when you work side by side with them. You see sides of them that they haven't been able to show on screen.
Yeah, that's what it was, is he just got to know her and thought she had the energy to do this movie. And she is far better than any of the women at Eddie Murphy's party. I do agree, Eddie Murphy's transformation's a little too quick. I have to think he'd have at least a week of living it up with all those people, right? Especially naked, gorgeous women, or at least naked, semi-attractive women showing up in his bed. And
yeah, if this was just a comedy that focused more on Eddie Murphy's character, I think we would have got that. We would have had a week of crazy partying, and then something would have snapped him. I got to be responsible. But all that, it just happens. We don't see it happen on the screen.
I feel like they have a nice balance in the beginning, and then sometime in the middle, it does become much more of Aykroyd's movie. Like, all of a sudden, Murphy gets a few scenes, but it's mostly about Aykroyd being humiliated and, you know, also seeing a different side of the working class. That, yes, he has to rely on Ophelia. He wants to compare her to Shakespeare, and she's like, no, this is the life, but I have a plan, and I'm going to use you. Like, if you're good for it, you're going to pay me back, and in 3 years, with all that I've already saved up, I can give up on the life.
This is so 80s that, yeah, she's invested her money, and yeah, she's a hooker with a plan to retire.
Yeah, hooker with a bank account of gold. And I like this character, though. It shows a side of a sex worker that I don't think I've seen often in films, especially before this time, where they were usually thought of as ditzy, lower class. Here, she is very intelligent, you know, and she's very beautiful, and you're going to see that.
Yeah, no, I think that is one of the things this film's trying to get at, is that there's two different kinds of smarts. There's book smarts and there's street smarts. And Ophelia is very street smart. I like that about her, that she's very capable. She knows how to pull these cons. She knows how to go about and make some money.
Shouldn't it have been played by a black actress, though? I do feel like originally with the title Black and White, and we saw that this character was racist and had certain presumptions about what Eddie Murphy was doing. I love Jamie Lee Curtis in this. I'm not saying I would want to replace, but I do think you might think about that. Maybe that was bold in 1983 to have interracial.
I think it was bold. It wasn't unheard of at that point. I mean, again, the Jeffersons had the interracial couple, and that was on well before this, but if you look at it as colorblind casting, though, I think Jamie Lee is absolutely perfect here. She and Aykroyd don't get a ton of scenes to play off each other. So when they do, the fact that the chemistry is as good as it is so important.
Well, he's got this other girl. We've had Penelope, and like, she's mostly existed in framed photos he has around the office and at home.
We get a pretty funny sex scene.
One really awkward, like, okay, I'm going to talk to you about my mom's party while we strip down. Yeah, the most unsexy sex scene I've seen in quite some time.
And a great way of exposition. Oh, I can't, boo. On the second is when the commodity report comes out.
Yeah, they set that up nicely. And so, yeah, she tried to bail him out, and we thought the wedding was pretty much called off then, but we really know when he goes there dressed in whatever mismatched outfits were left in Ophelia's closet from previous tenants. Yeah, she has moved on with the yuppies that used to be his friends.
This is the one scene, I know we had to put the nail in the coffin, but first of all, the entire douchebag quartet singing a song of how slutty the four girls are, followed by, yeah, the utter humiliation of Dan Aykroyd. It's just, his fall takes quite a while, and here, Penelope kept mentioning Todd, this whole time, so you got the feeling Penelope had a wandering eye anyway, but here she is with Todd.
Mm-hmm.
Arnie, when you said there was a scene that you feel could have been cut, I knew you were talking about this one, because I did feel that same way. Like, it's not particularly that hilarious. It goes on too long. I don't know why you need the a cappella group go in there. And yeah, we could have got this kind of information way quicker in a little scene. It goes on too long, but whatever. It's fine. It's not ruinous, but it could be cut.
You needed to get Lewis out of the house so that he could get in the rain. He can buy a gun, and then he can be in the rain looking through the restaurant window, seeing Eddie Murphy wine and dine clients and know that he's losing, get pneumonia. It's what gives him that tender moment with Ophelia. Up to this point, we believe he and Jamie Lee Curtis have a business arrangement, and then when she blows off a trick that comes to spend the night in her bed so that that Dan Aykroyd can recover from whatever he picks up from being out in the rain, his fever, that lets you know finally that this is more than just professional. She's falling for him.
Yeah, she takes off her top a second time and cuddles him and, you know, keeps him warm. The thing that I don't want to gloss over, though, are the coincidences of Winthorpe seeing Valentine repeatedly through windows. Like,
yeah, they seen a taxi at one point.
And he's like, that's my car, Coleman, that's my car. What is that Negro doing in my car?
Yeah, I like how each time they meet, it's this important development from the first time that they bumped into each other to, like, yeah, he sees Eddie Murphy in his former car and, like, ships in the night. They just, for a second, pass each other. He's going in a taxi with a hooker while this former bum is going to his job on his first day at Duke and Duke and quickly taking to it, like, realizes, oh, you guys are just a bunch of old bookies, and yeah, I know how to trade pork bellies too.
Which is a great line, because that's how bookies do work. Like, once they have too many bets for one team, they change the odds so people start betting for the other team, so it doesn't matter who wins, they're still going to get their cut. Like, I wish there is more street smarts like this coming from Eddie Murphy throughout. I would have just, he drops little lines here and there. I wish that would have been more of his character, though.
There are times when I feel Landis takes comedy risks. And sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. The one time I think he went too far, did you guys like Eddie Murphy breaking the fourth wall when he's like, and bacon, like you might have in a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich? And Eddie Murphy just looks out at the audience.
Yeah, I actually had to stop and rewind. I'm like, wait, did he just look at me? Did he just break the fourth wall? And look, I'm going to give it because it's funny. It's John Landis. And I just expect that with things like Blues Brothers. Like, it's very chaotic feel on the set, I feel like, with his films. Like, yeah, if it's funny, let's just throw it in. So yeah, I give it because it's Landis. Like, I don't know, if it was another film, if the comedy wasn't working so well, it might be kind of annoying, but I roll with this. I actually think it's kind of funny.
Again, I just want to see more of Eddie Murphy here, because there's an important development. Mortimer, as you say, the nemesis, the one that wants to insist that because Eddie Murphy is black, then he is just not going to be able to succeed in this world. You can see him fuming as Valentine is quickly taking to this commodities trading. And so he tries to trap him by leaving this money clip behind. And I like that moment. Like, the joke about the BLT, whatever. Again, in a movie like this, jokes come fast. Maybe you laugh at some. You laugh at the next one if you don't get this one. I thought it was interesting that we see Mortimer again and again losing. It's pretty clear that Randolph is going to win, that ultimately the movie's thesis is that, yeah, environment is all.
The way Murphy plays that, picking up the money clip, getting that big grin, like, I have some money, and then just sitting there and realizing that that's not the right thing to do, and these people gave him so much, and racing down the stairs to catch up to them and be like, count it, it's all there. I think that humanizes Valentine a lot. Eddie Murphy is such a big comedian. To become a human is sometimes tricky for him. And I think this is one of the scenes that helps with that.
Right. He's so much a smartass and a rule breaker. To see him in this moment, I agree that he can be appreciative of all that's happened. Suddenly he is now a character and not just Eddie Murphy doing bits. But this is all building towards Christmas Eve. And really, so, all right, Valentine has become, you know, a successful rich man, but that's not the bet. The bet is also that Dan Aykroyd has to become a criminal, and that's where we're going to see Bad Santa.
Yeah, Valentine is working late on Christmas Eve while everybody else is at a party. Meanwhile, Aykroyd, we did see him pawning his watch, the thinnest waterproof watch in North America.
That sounds like it must be an Apple Watch. That's something they would say. It's so thin.
I love Bo Diddley in that scene, too. He's awesome about, like, it looks like hot merchandise.
My fingers are getting burned from this.
Yeah.
This is the waterproof watch of the 80s.
Whatever that means. It ain't no Swatch.
Hey, in the 80s, to have a waterproof watch was pretty rad.
I get it.
Like, I was super excited as a kid when I had a waterproof watch.
I did, too.
Yeah, they've set up the gun, as they should, and so now he's got to use it. And I just wasn't prepared for the roast beef in between. Like, he's going to be raiding the catering table. And
yeah, I want to know how Dan Aykroyd got into this party with that Santa outfit. That thing is dirty.
I love the look of the guy. You don't see this person at first. You just see Dan Aykroyd in a Santa suit, stuffing rolls in his pocket, taking a full Santa...
Yes.
Shoving it down his coat. But then when he walks away, he'd been blocking somebody behind him who was getting their food, and that person looked so mortified at this guy shoving roast beef in his pockets.
Not only that, but it's also just a nice parallel, because what was Eddie Murphy doing at the beginning? He was stuffing things in his pocket. And when we saw Eddie Murphy in the beginning, he was on his knees. We've seen this character, like, I believe Ophelia picks him up off the ground and when he's on his knees. And they've just done a really nice job, sometimes subtle and sometimes overt, but always in a really smart way of telling the audience that, yeah, these two are the same. Even though we looked at them as incredibly different polarities, all he's got to do now is pull out the gun. And I don't know, he's even kind of worse than Eddie Murphy was in the beginning.
Oh, yeah, because he's going there with intent to harm, I think. Or I think he, at least when he pulls out a gun, he's feeling that pressure. But you talk about the similarities. They both figure out this Beaks thing. Like, you, Arnie, you said Billy Ray is doing work late Christmas Eve. It's because he's got to do that payroll and he's finding these checks for Beaks, just like Winthorpe did. And is this because it's a comedy? They never really try to keep that character a secret. Like, they give him away pretty early. Like, he's a character not to trust. Like, you know, this is no Weekend at Bernie's where it's like, oh, what's going on with this mysterious payroll that we figured out? Now we're getting a free trip to our boss's beach home.
No, I don't think you want it to be confusing. You want to have both characters seem smart because they both figure out something that is going on off books. And yeah, we know who Beaks is because he was the guy that framed Aykroyd and hired Ophelia and did all of the malfeasance and will really become a big central figure of importance as we move towards Act Three. But this is where Eddie Murphy's character is going to find out all about this wager.
Yeah, it's because Dan Aykroyd wanted to frame him for being a drug dealer the way he'd been framed. Pours just everything into...
He's got yellow pills, he's got red ones.
But Valentine sees a joint and is like, all right, I'll keep the joint.
Yeah, that was a nice detail.
I love that. Yeah, he's throwing everything away and then he pockets the joints.
Yeah, exactly. Because again, yeah, that's, you know, he's got that element to him still. And so he's going to enjoy that in the bathroom. And because he's trying to sneak a joint, he overhears. Yeah, it ends up being a dollar bet.
I mean, what is money to them? That when I first saw this movie, that was really the lesson I took away from it as a kid is like, yeah, why would they bet $1 billion? How many $1 billion do they have? A dollar.
Yeah, and it's also really effective to just show how callous the rich are. Like, we are going to ruin these men's lives over a dollar.
Right, exactly. That people are thought, they're like trading orange juice. I mean, it's just, these are people that have spent so much time manipulating. And again, they brag, though, in explaining what they did to Valentine. They made the point of saying, no matter whether the markets go up or low, we always get a commission. We always win. We always get the grift, no matter who succeeds or who fails. And so, yeah, these lives are just another commodity that's been traded.
Is it their racism that turns Billy Ray against them? Like, they're going to drop the N-word here. I guess all these Eddie Murphy films in the 80s, we're probably going to have to discuss this.
Yeah.
But they drop the N-word here, and, you know, maybe that's just to put a fine point on it, how bad these guys are. But that is when he, yeah, it looks like he starts scheming to get back at them.
I think it's when they say flip them back. I think the N-word drives the nail into the coffin. But I think once he found out that they were going to bring Winthorpe back, possibly. I mean, again, Mortimer being so nasty after what he did, I don't want Winthorpe back. But yeah, they were not going to have an N-word run their company. And so, yes, Valentine knows his days are numbered no matter what.
Yeah, and so it makes the team up seems right. And coming at the perfect time, Act 3.
Because Aykroyd did just do a suicide attempt. I mean, after the party, you saw him on the bus eating that salmon with the hair in it. Oh, my God.
No, oh, it's so great. It's like in his beard. Oh.
Yeah, it's he gets off the bus and then gets peed on. Like, I mean, it's just a compounding indignities.
Yeah, it starts raining on him, pouring on him.
And then he tries to kill himself. The gun won't fire. We think no bullets. He tosses it. The gun shoots something else. That man is just can't do anything. He goes home and overdoses on pills, though. He finds Ophelia medicine in her house and ODs.
Also, they can do this great joke of him waking up thinking it's a dream. You know, like, because Valentine is chasing him in a taxi and Ophelia knows who he is, they're able to transfer Lewis back to his original townhouse. He opens his eyes in the morning and thinks, oh, good. This is all just because of some terrible Negro. And Eddie Murphy's face on that reaction shot and the way he gets choked, all of
it's
this.
It's great.
Very, very satisfying.
Yeah, and Coleman being there, too. Mm-hmm. Oh, Coleman. It was such a terrible dream. And again, it goes a little far when he's strangling Eddie Murphy and pounding his head. It was the Dukes. It was the Dukes. But...
Yeah, we've enjoyed watching Aykroyd be humiliated enough. We now know who the real enemy is. They're both pawns in the Duke's game, and those are the people we want to get. And of course, you know, Aykroyd's like, he's like cleaning off like hunting rifles, thinking, I'll just go blow them away.
I'm telling you, Aykroyd, he gets some funny jokes in here. Like, yeah, that's when it cuts to him just cleaning the rifle, like, laughed out loud at that.
Yeah, it's Valentine that's like, you know what really hurts rich people is being poor. Let's figure out a way.
Yes.
A really contrived way. I got to say, the fact that Ophelia sees the man that hired her on TV with the top secret, like, farm report from Florida is, you know, convenient.
Yeah.
It is. And the fact that Valentine, I mean, I don't know if executives get headlines on the above the fold on the newspaper, new executive Valentine fires up Duke and Duke, so that it would be very easy for Lewis to keep up on Valentine's career. I'm not going to be worried about the tight logic of this in the fact that it is a comedy. And they set it up a little bit because the Dukes talking, one of them said, I hope we're not overreaching by using Beaks for this and the other job. And it turned out they were overreaching by using Beaks to do this and the crop report is their downfall.
Yeah, and I think Mortimer's going to even call that out at the end.
This is the stuff I remembered from the movie, was that it was like, I was like, it happens on a train, and they're in funny outfits.
That's my memory, too. Like, I thought this was like half the movie, all these antics dressed up. I'm like, my memory was, I did not like that. I don't like the trope of people dressed up as gorillas and people think it looks real, because no, it doesn't. But here's my question, guys. I'm from L.A. This is where I grew up. On New Year's, you either dress really nice or just dress casual, go to a party. Like, is this a Midwest or East Coast thing? Do people dress up like it's Halloween on New Year's Eve? I've never seen this.
They're in disguise. I mean, I think what you're talking about...
No. There's a whole car, this whole train. As you see Beaks getting onto this train, there's clowns. James Belushi is a gorilla. I'm like, this is an 80s film. I'm shocked that there's not a blackface joke.
But yeah, it is a costume party on the train.
Yeah, there's a costume party for New Year's Eve on a train. I've never heard of that tradition for New Year's.
It's probably one that went away if it ever was a real thing. And James Belushi is in a gorilla outfit, only slightly worse than the actor pretending to be the real gorilla. That is a terrible suit.
It's so bad. And this is kind of what stuck out to me. Like, I was dreading rewatching this film because I remember even as a kid just hating this gorilla stuff.
I actually kind of like the quote-unquote real gorilla stuff, some of the humor there. But the stuff on the train, you know, I've used this analogy before, but it's been a while. You know how you're listening to a song and then they go for one extra chorus, but they do a key change and it's like, so it sounds slightly different. I feel like here we're in the key change part. We're like, oh, there's still a half an hour left of this film and we're going on to a train now. I mean, it's a completely different atmosphere. We get Eddie Murphy pretending to be from Cameroon.
Oh, and this stuff, this is hilarious. Yeah, make the train scene just this stuff with all the players coming in the car. You know, it's beef jerky time. Like, I love it. I'm laughing at this stuff.
But Beaks has met at least most of them.
Yes, I know.
He may not have met Coleman, and he may not have met Valentine. We're not sure, because Valentine didn't need a lot of strings pulled. You know, the Dukes could do that, but he's met Winthorpe, he's met Ophelia briefly. I mean, I don't know that he'd remember that face.
Yeah, she had a wig on, though, yeah.
But it feels very risky, but I also like what Paul Gleason is doing with Beaks here. He sees the monkey, he makes monkey faces.
I hated that part. I hate that part so much.
It's just like, it's humanizing Beaks, who has been just like the Terminator.
No, it's going to make us cheer for when he gets ape-raped. That's why we want him to be ape-raped. He was making faces at that gorilla.
I appreciate the fact that he's smart enough not to fall for it. It is funny to see them try with their Swedish and Cameroon and blackface and drunken Irish priest outfits to pull one over.
Yeah, I love Coleman's character, yeah.
But Beaks is smart enough to go, you know what, this ain't right. And maybe they shouldn't have used a gorilla in a cage, but...
Or James Belushi.
Yes, maybe they should have used the ape in the cage and not James Belushi. I don't know. It's a little convenient.
Keep in mind Aykroyd and Belushi. He was friends with James, too, getting James a gig. And I have no problem with James Belushi here. It's not like I'm watching According to Jim.
Sure. And Al Franken is here, too. I did not remember this was an early role for Al Franken. He was one of the baggage carriers.
Oh, okay. I figured those had to be comedians because, again, cut this stuff. Like, there's so much time spent with them. Just, I mean, it's kind of funny, but it's not necessary.
I'll put it this way. It's the least smart of this very smart script.
Yeah.
It's like this kind of goofiness, but they've earned it. Here's the good news is you can get away with stupid shit when you've had 90 minutes of good. So,
yeah, it's not nearly as much as what I remember. Again, I remember this being like half the film gorilla antics, but no, it's about 10 minutes.
Yeah, that's it. It's weird to me because, I mean, the film kind of has two climaxes. The first is the suspense of getting the envelope from Beaks.
Right.
But then you still got the whole thing on the trading floor, too.
Right. Yeah, they're going to do a little All the President's Men, like Deep Throat. The Dukes try to get the farm report early in this darkened parking lot. And, of course, it's Eddie Murphy. And so we know, yeah, what's going to happen here. It's also where we get a little bit of the love story. We realize that all of that money that Ophelia has saved, she's going to give all of that to Lewis and is trusting him and his instincts to make her the rich person that she's made so many tricks for. I thought that was a nice detail.
And surprise, Coleman has money too.
Yes. I wouldn't like this movie nearly as much if it forgot about Coleman. The fact that he becomes a part of this climax and he's a part of the team and that he gets rich with them makes me like this movie so much more because they thought about the little guy, not just Eddie Murphy, but anybody that had to work for the Dukes and Dukes.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And Denholm Elliott, I didn't realize that was the same guy as Brody from the Indiana Jones movies, but I really do like him here. And then when we get to the trading floor, we're able to get a new type of humor. We see the traders. How's the ulcer? Doing okay? How's the hypertension? Has it bothered me in weeks?
And we do get a lot more voiceover, again, from Dan Aykroyd's character trying to explain what the plan is, what we're supposed to get, what we're supposed to follow. And I appreciate that because I had to think a long time to really, like, figure this all out of my head. Like, okay, what exactly did they accomplish here? I figured it out, but I'm glad they try to walk you through it.
All I'm saying is if Aykroyd really was a PCP dealer, he would make out like a bandit in this room.
Yes!
This
would be in that bathroom with all those stockbrokers.
Yes. He would really be enjoying it. But yeah, he's here to give the lay of the land to Eddie Murphy and the audience, who, again, has a tenuous understanding. And all we really need to understand is that winters are too cold, oranges die, and we don't get enough frozen orange juice.
Which makes the prices go up.
So yes, all of that is hanging in the balance, and one guy from the government is going to read what has already been read from the file at 9 a.m., because Dan Aykroyd has that inside information, he's able to sell and buy in the way that makes him rich. Makes them all rich.
And are people just allowed to come on to the the floor, the stock market floor, and sell stocks?
They have badges. They are traders. I'm assuming they got them from Duke and Duke.
I saw those.
And you got to think the Dukes may not have been smart enough to cancel Winthorpe's trading rights on the floor. But no, I couldn't just walk on the floor. But I watched this movie for years and years and got the gist of this ending, and kudos to Landis, because he knew he didn't understand this ending, and the way it's cut and scored and the actors, you get what happens, you get who's winning and who's losing in this. But I finally figured this out like a year ago. And so for anybody like me who didn't know what was going on and wants to, in the commodities, you deal with futures. So you're not buying today. It's January 2nd here. Aykroyd yells out, April. I'm going to sell orange juice in April. Orange juice he doesn't have. But that's what the futures are, is he's betting what the price of this is going to be in April. But he knows the price of this is going to plummet. But the Dukes think it's going to go up. They think there's less orange juice.
They're buying everything.
Yeah.
Because they think it's going to go up. Okay.
They're just like Ophelia on one hand, because they foolishly put their entire company, all of their millions and billions, are riding on this one trade.
Buy as much OJ as possible.
And then when the crop report comes out and says, oh, we have plenty of OJ for everybody.
Would the entire stock market stop to listen to a commodity report? Like,
yes, it would.
Yeah.
Really? Okay. Like, it seems so chaotic. I don't understand how the stock market works.
I worked on the Board of Trade. It was a horrible week for me, but I saw some of this up close in Chicago. And yeah, you would be surprised at what people get worked up over.
And this chaos on the floor with the papers everywhere and the shouting is exactly what it was like in the 80s. I don't know if it still is. They've kind of clamped down on secrecy since 9/11.
Yeah, my wife went to New York in the 80s where you could observe this. They had observation deck, and she's like, yep, this is true. They just scream at each other like this the whole time.
How does anything really get done, you wonder?
I don't know how it works.
Yeah, it's got to be those slips of paper, but
they're all over the floor at the end, though. I don't understand any of it.
I don't either. I do not understand how that shouting system works, but it does. And I've utilized it by calling my broker and say, do something, and that ended up with somebody shouting on a floor, but... Then when it comes out that the orange juice prices are plummeting, because remember, Valentine and Winthorpe didn't have any, but they were selling it. Now they're buying at a lower price than what they sold at. So they have to get enough to replenish all of their sales, or they're going to be stuck buying at whatever the price is. So they're instantly creating money out of nothing. They sold something they didn't have. And then when they got it, they just instantly profited.
Wall Street, what a scam.
Right. It really is a scam.
It is.
It really does feel like gambling to me. It's like, I'm betting orange juice is going to go. I mean, it's informed, but if you...
I have no money, but I can make $1 million just betting on the future.
Well, at the end of the day is the margin call. You have no money. Normally, you can pay only 10% of what you buy. I mean, that's just an institutionalized loan, but you have to give them 10% collateral called the margin. That's what kills the Dukes. They probably, you know, could sell their mansion or...
So their margin was $394 million? I thought that was everything they owed, but that's just 10%.
Right. They did $3.9 billion.
Wow.
So that's kind of in a high level. I still don't quite understand where the money goes in a commodities market the way I understand if you buy a stock, you own a part of a company. Do I own cases of orange juice somewhere? Could I just go and drink it instead of trade it? I don't know that. But at a high level, this is what is happening there. It is all very realistic. And yet you don't need to know a damn thing I just told you to know who won and who lost at the end of this.
Oh, no, it makes it very clear. I was trying to figure out all the mechanics just because I'm watching this for now playing and we got to discuss this. But yeah, if you just want to watch a comedy, they give you enough information so you know what's going on.
I mean, well, you see the villain literally go down. Randolph and the traitor that was working for them both, like, collapse. And it's just kind of funny that Mortimer doesn't even care. He's like, I'm more concerned about you turning on the machines.
No, he's like, sell those stocks!
Yeah.
As Randolph has a heart attack.
And it's carried away.
Amici did not want to say fuck him, but Lannis was like, then you don't get the job. Amici's like, I don't say the F words. He said, I'm doing this once. You better get this take. But it is great to see Mortimer. Fuck him! Turn those machines back on!
Agreed. I like this movie more because Don Amici, Eddie Murphy can say fuck all day long and it means nothing. But yeah, Don Amici saying fuck is just like the greatest thing. You'll never hear it in Moon Over Miami. I'll tell you that.
And then, you know, the movie's kind of over. We're told that the Dukes are done. We're told that nobody ever realized that gorilla costume Beaks was in was a costume. And thus, I'm picturing Beaks inside this costume. He's probably been raped by the gorilla. He's probably pissed himself, shit himself. He's probably dehydrated. His mouth is taped shut. He can't do anything.
Take the mask off! This is why I hate this.
Well, he's tried to take the mask off. It's stapled down or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, or something. I mean, they talked about how they had a trank gun. They could have just shot him with that and he's just passed out the whole time.
I gotta figure he's gonna die on that voyage.
Yeah, he's gonna die of the ape rape. It's gonna tear him apart.
But the more important, we can focus on the gross part, but I think the funnier part is that it's these working stiffs, the common man, that should be figuring all of this out. They're putting him on a boat. Eh, one gorilla.
There's no way these are union guys, because union dock workers stick to those bills for shipping. Like, if this says only one gorilla, they ain't lifting a finger for a second gorilla if it's not on that list.
They don't care. And again, they're off going, these apes are off for a science experiment. I thought that was a nice little detail as well, that something scientific is going to be done with gorillas in Africa, and away they go.
If scientists don't notice that's a human, they're bad. That's a bad science experiment.
More importantly, why would you be in Africa and ask America to send you a monkey?
I think that might be a joke, too. I think that Africa is ape deficient, and is importing them from New York is awfully funny.
But yeah, then we see just a really perfunctory end of, like you said, the characters are all on the beach. Coleman and Valentine got women from somewhere just because a happy ending means a woman.
Yes, in the 80s, this is what success means. You're just in Jamaica on a beach, sipping champagne on a yacht. They're retired. There's nothing else they need to do again.
I'm very confused because Winthorpe's on his boat, you know, and he's wearing a polo shirt with a long-sleeved knit sweater over it, and standing right next to him is Ophelia in the smallest bikini I've ever seen. I'm like, one of them is sweating balls or the other one is freezing. But yeah, it's just a happy ending because screw those one percenters.
It's a comedy. That's what you do.
You get a job. I mean, it's in the music that they play over the credits. Like, they don't have to work again. It is the ultimate fantasy that, you know, they seemingly are back at the beginning, except they look less trapped. I feel like Lewis doesn't look like the baby anymore. He is his own man. He doesn't have to work for anybody.
And Coleman's not on his boat. Coleman isn't bringing him the champagne. Coleman is being served as he'd had to serve many people before.
And it is so 80s, though, that, like, the lesson learned is not to, you know, work for income equity. It's get rich or die trying. Like, it is to join the 1%. Like, that is their journey.
Totally. Yeah, exactly so.
It's an 80s movie. That's called a happy ending.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yep.
But will we have a happy ending? Jacob, Stuart, do you recommend trading places? Actually, I'm going to trade places. Stuart, Jacob, do you recommend trading places? Stuart.
I had a really nice Christmas gift here. I thought I was sitting down to watch Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd do impressions, make pratfalls, and they do. They do a good job with that. But truthfully, I saw a really good attempt at a Frank Capra or Preston Surge's, like, revival. And that was happening throughout the 80s. Filmmakers were always trying to go back and recapture the screwball comedy vibe of the 1930s. And a lot of times they just ended up with, like, Mannequin and Secret of My Success. It didn't really look like It Happened One Night or Bringing Up Baby. But they tried a lot. Landis gets it right. He has a good script and he knows how to use these actors, get the best out of these actors to serve this script. It's a compliment to this movie that I'm going to say it would be just as good if you recast it with others. I'm not trying to say anything about Murphy and Aykroyd because they bring a lot to the party. But I do feel like it's the kind of comedy I like. I've talked about in the past, a lot of times they live or die by how you feel about the people on screen. And here, I feel it's situational, and it's the jokes that have been written. And yeah, what Aykroyd and Murphy do is just more to the party. They're an ensemble. And I don't know that there's too many Eddie Murphy movies where I feel like he's part of what's working. I usually feel like an Eddie Murphy is all about Eddie Murphy. So it was nice to see him share, be really good in a movie and share the wealth with Jamie Lee Curtis and Coleman and Don Ameche and Ralph Bellamy. I mean, they're all good here. And that's really something that should be celebrated. One of the best screwball comedies of the 80s. I'd have to go back and see Something Wild and Working Girl to be sure. But if it's not the best, it's in the top three. It's a really enjoyable film.
Jacob.
Yeah, we talk a lot about screwball comedies. It is not a genre that I am particularly familiar with. Like, I've seen one or two. But, like, watching this, that was always on my mind. I'm like, oh, this is like a throwback to those screwball comedies. It has, there's just something about that vibe where it's quick-witted with its jokes. There's some slapstick there. You got some romance. But, like, ultimately, like, Trading Places, is this about nature versus nurture? Does it have a whole lot of insight in that? I don't think so. Like, that's where I would ding this a little bit. Like, again, I talked about it with Valentine. Like, I wanted him explored a little bit more. Why is he so good when he starts trading commodities? What did he bring from the streets? But ultimately, it's a really good comedy, which surprised me because my memory was like, oh yeah, there's some funny Eddie Murphy stuff, and then there's that damn gorilla. Thankfully, there's not a whole lot of gorilla here. That is just something that was lodged in my mind. But yeah, I was surprised of how many times I laughed out loud as I watched this. And Stuart, I get what you're saying about how this, you could replace these actors, and because the script is so good, you could have an equally strong film. But I do want to praise the actors in this film for what they do, because we could play the hypothetical game, what if it was this person, that person, but Eddie Murphy, he does a great job here doing his Eddie Murphy thing. But it's who surprised me, Dan Aykroyd. Like, usually
nothing but trouble. Dan Aykroyd is nothing but trouble.
Yeah, that's the thing. I associate him with being a comedic actor, but either he's pretty perfunctionary, like in Ghostbusters, he's there to get a ghost blow job, or he's awful, like nothing but trouble.
Caddyshack 2. Woof, yeah.
Oh my God, that's terrible. That's one of his worst.
And so, like, I was shocked to see how funny he was here doing the straight man thing. And then when he got some comedic moments, like, I thought he was really good. Jamie Lee Curtis, really good here. That surprised me because, yeah, I usually associate her more with horror unless it's True Lies. But, like, this beat True Lies to that comedy thing. Like, she's great here. Like, all these actors are really fun. So, again, hypothetically, you could replace a lot of these, and I think it would still be a really good film. But I really appreciate the performances given here in this final product that Landis does turn in. It's a very funny film that still holds up. I've watched some old comedies that I thought were hilarious when I was a kid, and I'm like, not so hilarious now. Like, it just, they don't hold up, especially comedies, because humor is typically so grounded to its time. But this one, I feel just really works. Like, you could just put this in and still really enjoy this film, even though it's from 1983. So yeah, solid recommend for Trading Places.
And I think it works is because it is about the 80s, you know, like they really captured it.
And do I recommend this movie? I mean, I could answer in just one word.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think that you're dealing with something that is fairly timeless, despite its 80s trappings. If anything, the discussion about class has grown, not shrunk, since the early 80s. And I do agree the script is on point, but I gotta give a lot of credit to Landis as the conductor who's moving all of these things. When I talked about the breaking the fourth wall with Murphy, the thing that got me is the editing. If you'd let that go on for a beat longer, it would have pissed me off. But he cuts at just the right moment and cuts directly back to Mortimer, uninterrupted, continuing his speech about commodities and gold, that it works. And comedy is all about timing, and you can have the right actors in there, but if you have the wrong editor and the wrong director, it's not going to work. And here, I think this movie works. I agree with both of you. When we get to the train, I'm a little bit fatigued. I've enjoyed the movie so much that far that when we get to the train, it's like, it goes much bigger, but I'm along for the ride. I watch this movie regularly. I think it's a great Christmas gift to get to watch it again. So thank you to our listeners. I mean, rent and food aren't the only thing around here that costs money, and we're thankful that you guys donate to allow us to keep doing these shows. Thank you.
Right, and I hope you join us next week, because it's going to be January 1st. We want to get in shape. We want to pump you up. We're going to take January patrons to the movie that really did make Arnold Schwarzenegger a star. Before Terminator, he had Pumping Iron.
I have never seen it. I've read about it.
Nor have I.
I know Ferrigno's side of the story, but I do not know this movie.
I didn't know there were sides of the story. I'm looking forward to it now.
It will be interesting. I know you guys, at least you, Arnie, tend to be a fan of Arnold.
I mean, I was a kid in the 80s. Yeah, I like Arnold.
Yeah, let's see if you cast him as a hero or a villain in this, because I think he kind of works as both. It's an interesting perspective into his stardom and why he did succeed where Lou Ferrigno failed.
So we'll find that out next week as our January patron exclusive review. Thank you again, Jacob Stewart. Thank you for joining me. And now, beef jerky time.
The party's over.
The party's over? Hey, come on. What do you mean the party's over? It's not even 10 o'clock, you dummy. Hey, come on, loosen up, man. It's almost New Year's Eve.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign.
I have no money to give you.
Please, anything, a quarter, anything, just a couple of dollars, anything, a quarter, nickel.
And we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
Thank you.
It was a stone groove, my man. You are the most righteous.
Yeah, right. Just get the fuck out, man. Let's go.
Without patrons such as yourself, we couldn't keep doing the shows we put out every single Tuesday. So thanks to you all.
Food costs money and rent costs money. Now, you want me to help you out? I expect a lot in return.
By the way, food and rent are not the only things around here that cost money.
If you enjoy Now Playing, please head to iTunes and leave us a 5-star listing. It's the best way to help spread the word about the podcast.
Christmas, huh? I'll give him a Christmas present he'll never forget!
You can follow Now Playing on Facebook and Twitter, where we post announcements of new episodes and where the hosts post movie mini reviews. Links to our social media pages are available on our homepage.
Come in, my child. Join the party.
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
Will you be needing me any more this evening, sir?
No. I think I have everything I want.
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
Oh, lucky you.
It's not luck.
Now Playing is edited by Arnie.
Why is someone deliberately trying to ruin my life?
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
Thank you for correcting my English with Steve.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
It ain't cool being no jive turkey so close to Thanksgiving.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein.
Oh yes, I'm sure a lot of people went belly up on that one.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
You ain't talking to this guy. I want a lawyer. Is there a lawyer in the house?
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Is there a problem, officers?
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2020, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
I can see! I can see! I have legs! Oh, shit! Look at this! Man! I can walk! Jesus! Praise Jesus! I appreciate this. Oh, this is beautiful. I can't believe it. Thank you. I don't know what you're doing. Glory be to God. Praise Jesus. Look at me. This is too much. I can't believe it. I am beautiful. Listen, I can't thank you. First Moses, not him. God, Jesus. Look at me. I'm so happy. Oh, God. Look at me. This is too much. What a happy day. What a happy day. Thank you.
Yeah, nobody wants to talk about Top Secret, or not Top Secret. Nobody wants to talk about Best Defense.
I was going to say Top Secret. We can talk about that. It's funny.
You can see him fuming as Reggie is because he's not Reggie. That was the last movie.
Yes.
You see him.
Actually, I'm going to trade places. Stuart, Jacob, do you recommend trading places? Stuart.
Oh, okay. I go first. Yeah.
But you got to give my opinion or something. I'm not sure what we're supposed to do now.